read in the news recently that one of China's biggest car manufacturers is considering setting up their European research and development headquarters in Liverpool. Which led me to ask, why the heck didn't they use the headline,
"So Jerry, cross a..."
Nice to start Gareth Jones on speed with a laugh. He's Alex.
Hi.
He's Zog.
Hello.
And yeah, Cherry across the Mersey. That's what I want to talk about briefly.
Or Cherry on the Mersey, yes.
I wrote that song from the point of view of the Stellantis workers in Ellesmere Port who would point across the river and say, "It's Cherry across the Mersey."
Excellent.
A little local knowledge there. Yeah. How are we, boys? Well, better than me, I hope. I've had shingles.
Oh, that really sucks. Yeah, that's horrid. That's horrid.
Alex, you're getting married.
Yeah, apparently.
Can we all give him a round of applause?
We don't need to
talk. Congratulations.
Thank you, friends.
Come on.
Last week was very lovely and very emotional. Lots of happy tears and lots of booze. I think the hangover's cleared, but it turned into a nice chest and coffee thing that's been doing the rounds, which all of my friends have been taken down by, or a lot of my friends have been taken down by, which is why I sound a little bit more gravelly than usual. It's not a learned gravitas, sadly. It's just I'm slowly dying.
We all are, mate.
Well, entropy is after us. We're all slowly dying. It just sometimes speeds up a little bit and occasionally slows down a little bit. So you've got a bad shoulder, man. I hear you can't even go and fire arrows and bullets at things, right?
Yeah, I've got a frozen shoulder, which has been getting worse, and in the last few weeks it started to actually seriously affect a lot of physical activities. Yeah, without tedious detail, I can't do any archery at the moment. It's affecting what I can do shooting wise, which is another one of my hobbies. But the really annoying thing is it's affecting some everyday stuff, like putting on and taking off t-shirts is extremely difficult with my right arm, so my left arm's doing that. And there's actually kind of one of the most annoying ones is because this is harder to control. If I have a reflex action involving my right arm, so if I touch a hot thing in the kitchen, or if I drop something and do that reflex action of reaching out to catch it,
yeah,
that is now very painful. Oh. And that's not the kind of thing you can, you know. I'm kind of getting everything off high shelves with my left arm now, with my non-dominant arm, and I'm, you know, all of those other sort of routine stuff. I'm just doing my left arm, which is, you know, fairly manageable.
Hey, in times like this, I bet you'd give your right arm to be ambidextrous, wouldn't you?
And indeed.
Sorry to bring us back to joy, because we're all getting a bit maudlin now, apart from Alex, who's full of love. That's beautiful. But hey, can it bring us back to Cherry? We've talked quite a lot about the progress of the Chinese motor industry over the programme this year, and it seems to be we're on message, right? Because Cherry are coming here. What are they doing? They're setting up an R&D centre, a European centre, and there is further talk of the potential of them using Jaguar Land Rover's Halewood factory to possibly build Cherry vehicles over here. Good news or bad news, Alex?
Smart news, if it does happen. It's strange, I was listening to a podcast today about whether or not that was going to be a thing. The thing is, converting factories to do that sort of thing isn't the work of a minute, and Chinese firms do work alarmingly quickly.
Yeah.
Like, there is the sort of turnaround, like I think there's some statistic, BYD or Geely, I can't remember which one it was, but there wasn't a factory there, and then 18 months there was, and it was moving and it was doing stuff, which is quick, like really quick, and not in the "we built the DeLorean factory in record time" quick, because we all know what happened there. But yeah, whether or not they can actually pull that off would be something else. And if they decide to, I mean, fair play. It gets around a lot of regulatory stuff. It means if there are tariffs on cars, I'm not sure what the latest thing is. It depends on what the latest tariff situation is in various bits of the world and how the cars get here or cars get from here to other places. Mm-hmm. But it would solve a few problems. I mean, something I think we were talking about on the last episode, where the chap from Geely was saying, well, if we need to, and if the maths worked out, we could use Hethel to build Geely cars.
Yeah, we did talk about that. Yeah,
kind of terrifying, but also kind of like, well, it kind of makes sense, right? If the ability for them to do it is there and the maths does do the maths, then why not? It means cars can be built quicker, they can be built to regulation, they can be built X, Y, Z to where they need to be, so why not? But that actually happening, would Jaguar Land Rover willingly give up that space? What happens if it grows exponentially and the, say, the Type 00 becomes the next best thing and they need extra space to build it, or the next vehicle needs space to go? Like, what happens there, unless, you know, they do just take the money, do the thing and have the fun?
Well, they need the money to get over the hump at the moment. Money is tight in the European car industry. Do you remember when we started manufacturing Japanese cars in Britain? And now Toyota in Burniston, Toyota's engine plant in Flintshire as well, here in North Wales, and Washington, Tyne and Wear for Nissan. You know, they are major players and providing huge amounts of wealth for the UK and lots of employment for people. I wonder if they produce more cars than the other manufacturers in Britain, you know, JLR and Mini. And Rolls-Royce, is Stellantis building any cars over here? What's happening in Ellesmere Port? It's all vans now, isn't it? And Luton. God.
I mean, Rolls produces like 5,500 cars a year, if that. Yeah. So they're sort of a rounding error on the country's, on the country's car production numbers. Mini, is last year produced just the Cooper. There, it produced 165,000 cars for the global market.
Not massive, is it?
If they can make the maths work, and if it means JLR gets a stay of execution and can keep its facility, then great. But undoing that would be difficult.
Yeah. It's a dependency then, isn't it? So, what's your view on Chinese manufacturing in the UK?
Well, I think you summed up at the start there quite well what we know about it, and it's not clear exactly how this UK base that they're setting up is going to develop. But cautiously, I think good thing. It's going to be bringing employment, and having Chinese companies operating in the UK rather than operating entirely in China, I think has to be a good thing for the UK.
Yeah.
It also, I'm sure, benefits Chery. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it. But yeah, cautiously optimistic, I think.
Interesting, you mentioned earlier on, Alex, about how quickly Chinese companies turn things around. Chinese industrial manufacturing development culture is the same across not just the motor industry at the moment, but their fifth generation fighter and sixth generation fighter has been turned around in incredible amounts of time. The Chinese space program is making, pun intended, giant leaps very, very, very quickly. You know, they're tooling up for, as we've discussed, a manned moon landing. They've got reusable spacecraft coming, which they're turning around in 18 months. So let's see what we're talking about on this program in 18 months, because I bet something significant in Chinese will have happened by then, I reckon. Hey, yeah, I'm all for it. Go for it. Come on. Work for the people, right? And let's bounce back against Trumpian politics. I see it as part of that as well. Poking the eye to Trump.
I'm not sure quite how it in any way plays into Trumpian or non-Trumpian politics, but yeah, whatever.
Well, I'm sure it'll just wind him up if Britain's doing deals with China, and that's got to be a good thing. Right, what else you got, you guys? What else you got? Alex, what's new in your universe?
I can talk to you about a thing I couldn't talk to you about last time, so it's not the newest news, but it's really cool. I went to the Netherlands early in January, and I went to see a donkervoort.
A donker what?
And the crowd goes mild. It's a donkervoort. Have you not heard of a donkervoort?
Apparently not.
We don't get them
it's
here.
It's a Dutch sports car, right?
It's a Dutch sports car. We don't really get them here because they're all left hookers and they're quite expensive, or they are now anyway.
It does ring a bit of a bell, actually, but yeah.
So the company story goes, about 50 years ago-ish, a man called Joop Donkervoort decided he wanted to tool around the Netherlands in a Lotus or Caterham 7, something like that. And he found out that the Dutch government wouldn't let them in. So rather than go, oh, well, I'll go and buy another car, he went, sod it, I'm going to build my own.
I love those sort of people.
Yeah, it's great. And like the early cars, I think it's the S7 is the first one, looks a lot like a Caterham. And sort of the really early ones look Caterham, but wheels on the wrong side, and there are a few bits done to it to make it suitable for the Netherlands. But as time went on, whereas Caterham kind of doggedly stuck to being, you know, small engine, lightweight, similar size and shape, nothing dramatic. There are little incremental changes that have gone on over the years. But Donkervoort, it went from a four-cylinder to a V6 very briefly, and that was a bit disastrous. And then it struck up a deal with Audi and started using Audi engines, so their turbo fours, and then turbo five. So the last time I drove a Donkervoort, I think it was about 11, 12 years ago, flew out there and had a go in the D8 GTO, which had a ridiculously powerful Audi 5 pot in it. And it's a bit bigger, it's a bit plush, it feels like a more complete car, like the door feels like a door, it's not a thing of fabric or plastic or whatever it is in a Caterham. The windows are actually windows, the roof is a proper T-top, so you remove big chunks of actual material. They're wider, they're sort of carbon fibre, there's loads more power, it's like proper race car stuff in them, right? Whereas a Caterham is a race car, because a Caterham builds on two race car standards, the Donkervoorts are kind of a bit more grown up. Well, grown up's the wrong word, but it's a bit more hardcore than that, right? Anyway, fast forward to now, and Denis Donkervoort, Joep's son, has taken over the company, and he's launched the P24RS. P stands for his daughter, Phoebe. All the cars, the initial stands for one of the kids' names, so D in D8 is Denis. And it's his first baby. So Joep, I had a good sit-down chat with him, and Joep was saying that he's an engineer, right? He wants to build the best Donkervoort for Joep Donkervoort, or Joep Donkervoort, sorry. My Dutch pronunciation is terrible. Apologies, listeners. Whereas Denny is a bit more pragmatic about these things. He's not an engineer, he admits that, but he loves tech, he likes trying new things, but he's spending more time with customers and spending more time kind of learning what the community likes, because they're only going to build, you know, 100 odd of these things. So is there going to be 100 people that own them? So
you can almost see that cultural change in the car, because when you look at it, it looks like a sci-fi Caterham 7 is the best way to describe it.
The F22 that went before it, this is very much an evolution of that. So it's got quite similar hallmarks. Donkervoort's cars are all kind of, they have the same layout. It's the same sort of Caterham-y layout. Engine up the front, person in the middle, drive at the back, light as possible, right? So the F22 had the Audi 5 pot. That was 500 odd horsepower, I think. This one has 600 horsepower.
How heavy is it? Oh, sorry, it's not even heavy, is it?
No.
How light is it?
It's like 800 kilos or some nonsense like that.
God, great.
It's absolutely ridiculous. It's got the 3.5-litre Ford V6 out of what you get in the Ford GT and the Raptors and all that, right? Except it's got different turbos on it to make 600 horsepower. And he was saying, like, moving away from the Audi engines and going to the Ford ones is quite fascinating for them, because with Audi comes a lot of caveats. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can do this, you can do that. Whereas the point he made is, like, once Ford has said you can have the engines, you can put sand in it if you want to, they don't care. Like, you've done your job. Like, the deal's been done, off you go, fill your boots. And it's really quite mad to look at. It's got this big old gaping moor. It's got some quite cool headlights. So it's brought back pop-up headlights.
Nice.
So it's got some little kind of slits across the nose. But then when you want to go full beam, you press a button and out from either side of the nose, they sort of pop up sideways. They pop out of the body and up.
Rather than
like an MX-5, they sort of like little wings appear from the side, which is very, very cool.
Having just pulled a few pictures up here, I mean, the previous car, the D8 and the F22.
The F22 is the one that immediately precedes it.
Yeah, I mean, they've both got quite a lot of the... if you think Caterham 7 meets Batmobile, you know, the kind of Clooney-era Batmobile, that to me is the look they've got.
Yeah.
And then the P24, it's still very much in that similar vein, but it's getting a bit more... I mean, I'm going to say Aston Martin, but that's partly because of the colour.
It's green.
It's partly because of the green. But, yeah, it's bonkers.
The word bonkers And forgive me for stereotyping here, but the word bonkers and Dutch do often go hand in hand. Yeah. I adore them for that. They do bonkers as it is normal. That was normal. And did you drive this thing? I mean, it must have been insanity.
No, no. What? Not allowed to drive it. I mean, it was the Netherlands. I think it was the 6th of January I went, and there was lots of snow. It was very, very snowy. But I had a good look around the factory, and they had laid on an F-22 to drive. But we all went, no, there's snow. I don't want to die. And which was, yeah, entirely fair, frankly. Other than it looking absolutely batshit and being delightful, there's something quite cool about it, because Donkervoort's recognised that it's got two types of drivers. It's got the ones that just want something cool and a bit different. And these cars are used. They don't sit in a collection or anything like that. They're used. So some people that want to take it out on a nice road and have a nice day. And there are some people that want to go to the track and beast everything for fun. But they don't want to build something that can be used by one but not the other. So they've got removable aero. So in the pictures, you might see sort of a weird wing on the rear and a big chunky chin spoiler with big sticky outy bits at the front. If you're on the Motor One story, those are my pictures. So they're definitely there and they're removable. So you can pop them on and pop them off when you go to the circuit or if you want to give it a little bit of extra. But they're made by another Donkervoort company called X-Core. Now, this is a new way of doing carbon fibre that doesn't require an autoclave and doesn't require XYZ, and you can do it on your desk, sort of. So what they do is you decide what shape you want a thing to be, you make a casting of it, and then you lay the carbon fibre on the casting, and then you put the two bits together and fill it with foam. And then there are heating elements in the casting and you basically bake it on your desk.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it's quicker. I think I didn't ask price because such things are vulgar, but you don't need an autoclave to do it, which means it's a little bit easier to get around. And you can build things in bits and then form them together. Or if you need a new front splittery bit or a new rear wing because something's happened, you can just ring them up and they'll bake one for you and you can have it in a handful of hours.
Nice.
And the tech on demand. Is not just theirs. So, yeah.
It's like streaming like your car, isn't it? We're so used to streaming television and everything now. You want an on-demand car. Oh, I need a cup holder. I'll design.
So long as the moulding's there for it. And they were saying that it's already been used in the yacht industry, so it's on super yachts already because they can build a big piece in one mould or in two moulds and then bond it together more easily than, say, someone with an autoclave where you're limited by the size of the box, basically. They've already got bits on Toyota's rally cars. There's bits going on the Le Mans cars because they can do it there.
Right, yeah.
They can do it easily. So if something does go awry, you can just cook yourself up another one quite quickly. And the way they're kind of keeping the tech proprietary is they're the ones building the molds. So they teach you how to use it and teach you how to do it, but then...
And the strength is the same? It's you get really the same smart. Structural strength?
Yeah, yeah.
That you would have done with the autoclave production technique. There's no compromise in those terms.
Yeah.
Okay. No. Sounds good.
From what the man selling it told me.
Okay. Important caveat. But then again, you know, they're not, I think, a company that's going to be making important aero bits with a subpar technique.
It's a properly impressive bit of tech because, yeah, I went up to the X-Core bit of the buildings. They've got their HQ in Lelystad, I think it's called. And it's basically a big shed where people build cars, not unlike, say, the Caterham factory. But the back end of it is you go through a door that says X-Core, and it's just a sort of a floor of the building with lots of these metal castings and casings in them. And they're like, oh yeah, I watched a man sort of gently laying the fiber in one of the molds and it did its job perfectly and it looks absolutely mega. You can turn stuff around. Yeah, they were saying like it's a matter of hours, not days.
So this is a very rigid, very light, very powerful thing of complete insanity.
Yes, it's excellent.
We love it. Thank you for bringing it to our attention. I hadn't thought about Donkervoort for a long time. I remember when they were originally producing the Lotus 7 facsimile.
F7.
Yeah. That was a while ago, many years ago. But I
do have one more bit of very good news to share.
Okay.
I recently drove the new Ineos Grenadier. They've given it a refresh.
Ah, yeah.
And to be honest, most of everything, pretty much the same. There's some new trim bits. There's some new stuff you can do with it. But they fixed the steering, sort of.
That was what... Yeah, sort of. Really?
Sort of. So it's still... It's the same reticulating ball. But they've tweaked it so it's not so mobile. It's a lot more stable on the road. It still doesn't self-correct itself. It still doesn't correct itself like what normal steering does.
Yeah.
But it's so much better. It's transformed the car. It's gone from, you know, on the road a 2.5 to a 3.
Well, we took one, as you know, to Le Mans last year, drove it extensively, and a lot of great, great things about that vehicle. The steering wasn't one of them, but in its defence, I found that sort of nervousness with the steering wheel, that I'm driving a truck here, forced you to drive a little more slowly and perhaps not hurry it around like the three-ton thing that it is or whatever it is, you know.
Turning circle smaller as well.
Ah, I'm glad to hear this. I wish the Grenadier well, right? Because this is another example of that, oh, they won't sell me one, I'm going to have to build one myself, which you mentioned earlier on.
Like Donkervoort.
Yeah, exactly that, yeah. And it's a great, great car. Whether the market is sufficiently large to allow it to continue in the form that it does, I don't know. I know they're talking about a smaller Grenadier. What's it called? The...
The Fusilier.
Fusilier, yeah. I'm hoping they get to that because they're building a brand there and I think they're good. Mm. They're working on it. Zoggy wanted to bring something to our attention regarding Sir Lewis Hamilton.
Right. Sir Lewis Hamilton. Well, yes, just in the last couple of days, we've had Lewis Hamilton news. And I'm not quite sure what to make of these, but he's... He's split with his manager, his long-term manager, Mark Hind, who he's been with for years. And, of course, he split with his race engineer, or he has a new race engineer at Ferrari now. And he's got together with Kim Kardashian, apparently. Kim Kardashian is his new girlfriend. And I don't know quite what to make of all of these things. I'd like to hear that he's been, you know, testing the new Ferrari and it's amazing and he's convinced he's going to win the world championship in it. I don't think splitting with your manager and getting a new race engineer are necessarily good things.
Lewis Hamilton and Kim Kardashian?
I mean, look, I don't know Kim Kardashian. I don't want to, you know, speak ill of somebody that I don't really... She may be a very lovely, very decent person, but she has kind of put out into the culture, it seems to me, an awful lot of terrible drivel and encouraged an awful lot of... part of a kind of a rather bad feedback loop of encouraging vacuous consumerism and very poorly thought-out ideas.
Wow.
Endless... ghastly reality TV nonsense. Yeah, I don't know. But to look at it in a positive way, people getting their personal lives together has to be a good thing. You know, if he's happy in his personal life, great. That can only be a good thing. But splitting with key people like that and then getting together with, you know, high-profile new girlfriend like this, I don't know, it doesn't sound like a great way to start 2026 to me. What do you reckon?
Kim Kardashian, I've never, ever, ever watched Keep Up With Dave Kardashian or whatever it's called, that programme. And I don't think I would recognise Kim Kardashian unless she was captioned in an image. I know very little about them, the Kardashians, other than they were a brilliant evil race in Star Trek, but that's a different Kardashian.
Their cars all have four lights.
There are four lights.
It took a while, but we got there in the end. Bloody hell.
Deep next gen, nice. But I'm just, I don't know. I feel disappointed in Lewis. I was hoping that he would go for, I don't know, an intellectual giant rather than what appears to be, as you described in some form, a fairly vacuous, self-grandizing entity. But they're okay.
Well, I'll
but good luck to
him. I'll come out swinging in their defense. I mean, they like each other.
Yeah.
They have a nice time together.
Yeah.
I mean, I read on the front page of the paper today
because
I went for a stroll at lunchtime. They had three dates in a week. That doesn't mean they're in a relationship. That means they're having dinner.
Correct.
Yeah. I'm not about to talk. I'm absolutely not in the business of, you know, telling Lewis Hamilton or having a strong opinion on who he should be going out with.
He should be going out with an intellectual giant, life. I'm telling
he
you.
He should live it in the way that he wants.
Hey, do you know what? I think being Lewis Hamilton is like being Robbie Williams from Take That. I think it's really hard. Everybody wants a bit of you the second you step outside the door. And I'm certain it's the same for Kim Kardashian. And so therefore
she is one of the most famous people in the world.
Yeah.
How she got there might not be to everyone's taste. She does have a massive audience.
Yeah, but as I would say, fame is best enjoyed by those who desire it. Right, that'll teach them. So, yeah, they have much in common. They will both share that understanding of what it's like to be public property and have no privacy. So, good luck to them finding privacy. Ha!
Yeah, although I suspect there is a bit of a difference between them in that sense. You're quite right. I think it can be very difficult for people who are massively in the public eye to sometimes maintain relationships with people who are from a completely different world. That can be difficult.
Yeah.
I suspect that while Lewis is rather wary of, he's in the public eye, he's very much a public figure, I don't think he really encourages attention. He's not somebody that, you know, calls up the tabloid press all the time to let them know when he's going to be leaving a certain nightclub there's going to be a photo opportunity. And I think that's a little bit more Kim Kardashian's brand of way of being in the public eye. Yeah, but, you know, best wishes. Good luck to them.
You know what's going to happen, don't you? There's going to be a reality TV series called Hanging Out with the Hamiltons. Oh, God, no. And now a Gareth Jones on Speed Sting in the style of Queen. I was listening to Six Music the other day, as I often do. Guy Garvey, lovely Guy Garvey. Hello, everything's normal, my finest hour. Don't worry, it's just Guy Garvey. He's the...
Mr. Elbow.
Elbow, yeah. Guy Garvey is the Graham Loudon of rock and roll. Very softly spoken, northern, easygoing. Thank you. Anyway, he played a tune by a band I used to love a long time ago called The Wedding Present. David Gedge, I interviewed him a couple of times. He's a good Leeds lad, straightforward rock and roll. And he played this song called Hot Wheels, which I hadn't heard before. And I thought, oh yeah, Hot Wheels, it sent me down an avenue. And I realised something. I didn't have any Hot Wheels track when I was a kid. I had Corgi Rockets, and there were two key differences between Hot Wheels and Corgi Rockets. Hot Wheels, segmented track that you join short sections together. Corgi Rockets was a continuous long piece before you had a join, and that made it smoother. The cars went quicker. Also, Corgi Rockets cars were different to Mattel Hot Wheels in that you had this key that you used to release. If you turned it over, you released like a backbone chassis, a plastic polythene chassis, T-shaped, with the wheels on it, and you could lubricate the wheels. I think it was silicon lubricant, and put it back in, and they would run quicker than Mattel Hot Wheels. Corgi Rockets were better than Hot Wheels. Discuss. Maybe not you guys. I don't know if you went down that sort of avenue, but this is what I want to discuss. Our relationship with toy and model cars, when it started for each of us, and why we do it, why we still do it, and will it ever end? My first memory of the first toy car I ever had predated Hot Wheels by many years. Pretty sure it was a Ferrari P196. I had a P196, but I also had a Ferrari 250 LM lift-up back.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, which I think must have been Corgi. I think they were both Corgi. I also remember, of course, having the Lotus 72, the John Player Special, Lotus, Emerson, of course. Mm. and a UOP shadow. But I can't remember if it was Tom Price in the driver's seat. I think it was a generic helmet. And they were like the earliest.
I've met a few people that go by that description.
Hey! They were the earliest toy cars. Do you remember your very first... Actually, I just thought of another one. I had a pedal car before that when I was about 4 years old, which I inherited from my older brother, which looked a bit like a Triumph Herald. Alex, what was your earliest memory of a toy car you owned, a specific model or anything?
No, I mean, I seem to remember as a kid, I sort of inherited or kind of collected a box of these things. But my sort of blooming into car land came comparatively late in life. But I do remember, was it Shell? Did a model car thing. It was either Shell or Jet. I can't remember which one it was. And if you bought enough fuel, you'd get a model car of some description.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I remember a BMW Z1 that had the doors that went down. I didn't know it was a Z1 at the time.
Yeah.
I just remember thinking, I want the one with the blue and the white on the nose and the funny doors. And so that'll be sort of somewhere in Mum's house. I will admit, I can't quite remember the Corgi Rockets. I think those became sort of unsafe for children by the time I was a child. sorry about that.
How my generation ever survived the 60s and the 70s, I will never know. I should not be here. How about you, Z? First toy car, model car, do you remember?
Well, Hot Wheels and Corgi Rockets, was it?
Yeah.
I mean, they were never part of my childhood. They just weren't, never really came across them. You know, I had some little matchbox cars as a child, you know, none of which, I can't remember any particular models. Yeah, they were just little model cars that I was playing with. The first identifiable car, the first thing that I can remember, being attached to and having a connection with, or the first couple, were when I started making model kits. And I remember making quite early on an Airfix Bugatti Type 35,
which I think was a
1/32 scale model, which is a very pretty little thing and may well have been part of why I had an interest in Bugatti for so long. The Tamiya Lotus 72, you mentioned a Lotus 72 in your book.
Yeah.
I remember making at least one little Tamiya John Player Special, which was a beautiful little model. And then other Tamiya kits over the years were part of my journey through and in car culture. The Tyrrell P34 six-wheeler, the
good
big
lad.
Tamiya kit. I wanted one of those for years, and
it
wasn't that long. But I remember envying that thing. Eventually got one and did an okay job of building it. Actually, in all honesty, that's a slightly sort of disappointing and frustrating kit to build.
It's tricky.
I think unless you're a really good model builder, which I wasn't, that front suspension is very tricky to get right. And, you know, for anyone that isn't familiar with that particular Tamiya kit or type of Tamiya kit, this is a scale and design that has front suspension that has, you know, working suspension with real springs and working steering. But of course, this is all with fiddly little plastic bits that
sometimes get broken.
When you
or
have this six-wheel steering and six-wheel suspension is quite a challenge. Probably even, like I say, for a really good kit builder, but that was a great model. And then later on, I kind of embarked on the 1/43 scale car journey, and, you know, got quite a few of those kits, most of which are, you know, pre-made. I've made a couple of 1/34 scale resin cars, one of which I admit I made because I said, oh, I want that, when I saw it in the model shop, and only then discovered quite how much a nice 1/43 scale model can cost you if somebody's built it up from a little kit. And I am not prepared to pay that much for a model car that small. So I bought the resin kit, mostly to save face. By this point, I was a bit better at making models, though, and actually it came out really, really nicely. And then, so more recently, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, I've bought a couple of very nice CMC metal 1/18 scale models. They're very kind of high detail models. There's a Bugatti Type 34. Sterling Moss's 1955 Mille Miglia, Mercedes 300 SLR.
Yes.
Oh, that's a beautiful little kit, beautiful model. So, yeah, I've got a few.
That's you all over there, Zog, isn't it? Bugatti and Sterling. Yeah, that's so lovely. Yeah. That's all it's like in your head. All you got to do to find out what's like in your head is to walk into one of your rooms. I've got over 130 1/43rd scale diecast models now. My collection started when, I think in about 95, I was working on a BBC radio programme, and the producer, Julian Mayers, for my birthday, bought me John O'Lacey in a Ferrari 194, I think it was. O'Lacey's only win. Ah, because I loved O'Lacey. I love Ferrari.
Canadian Grand Prix.
Yeah, and so the first one I think I bought after that was a Tyrrell P34. And then I started collecting world champions in the years that they drove that car. Then I started collecting the cars they drove in the years before and afterwards. Then the drivers I'd met in the cars that they were driving when I met them, like Martin Brundle in his Toyota GT1. And then I started collecting all the Le Mans winners, and I'm still collecting all of these. They're all in a box at the moment. Some are on display, some. I've got a Ferrari on display. I won't show you now. It's radio. It's audio. But I don't think it'll ever end. I'm just going to have to keep collecting it. It's a record of the history of motorsport. I love watching the cars evolve. That's the joy I get. My relationship with cars predates all that as well. My dad built a go-kart, a really quite trick bit of go-karting with a central brake lever, and it had an aerodynamic fairing and stuff. He built it for a rotary go-karting competition, and then I got to play with it all the time. I've actually got cine film of me freewheeling it down the avenue where I lived, and I'm like 6 years old or something. I'm driving my first car. So, you know, the question is, right, are we interested in cars now because we were interested in cars when we were kids, and we're just trying to grasp our childhood back, or are there other reasons for this collection, these items that we buy? Because, Alex, you're not exempt from this as well. I know you've got lots of Lego models and lots of starships.
Well, I've also got thousands of Hot Wheels scattered around my desk. I can see four, eight in front of me. Including Matchbox did a Morgan three-wheeler, and my mate Will,
of course,
did one of my
In your colour.
Your colour, and
it's purple,
got the right
and
registration.
It's got a shark face and and the right red as well. Yeah, it's.
I've got my Sora and I've got my Cappuccino, but I haven't yet got my Cactus, and I haven't got my old Jetta. I haven't got my Lancia HPE. There are a number of cars in my collection I should have, I haven't got.
I think the thing with models. So I was noodling this earlier. The thing about cars and liking cars is that they're really, really great, except normal people can only really afford one at a time, maybe two. A sensible one and a silly one, if you're lucky, right? And you can admire them from afar, and you can go to shows, or you can go to places like Goodwood, or you can go to meets or whatever and go, wow, I really like that. And you can get all the information about them from the owner or from forums or from videos and all that stuff. And you can immerse yourself within that sort of sphere, but you can't have all of them unless you are insanely wealthy. Whereas if you're interested in, I don't know, video games, bar like a few outliers, for example, if you want to buy a copy of a PlayStation 2 game called Kuon, it'll cost you £625, according to a man I saw on Instagram the other day. But you can pick up all of the games you want. You can buy one in each series, and you can play them, and you can immerse yourself in it, and it can be your little slice. Or if you're interested in, say, Star Trek action figures, if you want to pick them up, you can, because they're, you know, a five or a ten or whatever, or however much they are these days, I don't know. But you can have that little thing in your life. So model cars and toys and things like that, these things, they're tiny facsimiles of a moment in time that was thought out. You know, a car, so what am I going to grab in front of me? So I've got this Aston Vantage GT3, last gen one with the gaping maw, not the traditional maw, right? This car will have gone through years of development and refining to become the thing it is. I'm never going to afford one of those things. I'm never going to even get in one. Like, getting near to them is privilege enough. But I can have this tiny thing that is a pared down version with stickers on it, not with working lights or this and that, but I can have that representation of all that it is right on my desk, and I can have it for £2 in Sainsbury's.
Yeah.
And so it just, it invites you into that little world, invites you into that space that you follow so closely and you wish that you could be a part of, and you wish you could be involved in and wrap yourself up.
Yeah, it's like a little physical token.
Because you don't have £500,000, you can't.
It's your little part of it, isn't it?
Mm. Mm.
Just to get back to, you mentioned a moment ago, Gareth, that you collected, you know, some of your old cars, cars that you have owned, and you know, I've done the same. It's a way to memorialise that, you know, car that you drove and loved. But the annoying thing about doing this is that they are almost invariably left-hand drive models of a car that you had in right-hand drive. And that's the annoying bit. I haven't found a solution to that yet.
I did find a right-hand drive Sora, the same model as mine, from Japan. I'm very pleased about that. But yeah, the Lancias are all the wrong colour. They're all the wrong series. It's got to be the right one, right? Can't be. I didn't have that car. That's got to be that exact car. Yeah. Will it ever end? Are we going to continue doing this forever?
I mean, there is
liking toys. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I mean, I can think of, you know, particular models that I would buy right now if they were a lot cheaper, you know. But but you know, but there are, yeah, again, there are some lovely, really beautiful CMC models that I get at the drop of a hat, but they are kind of expensive. And but actually, doing a little bit of research, I found that the Revel 1/12 scale Ferrari 126 C2 that I built a few years ago. This is the Gilles Villeneuve Ferrari.
Yeah.
Which I built a few years ago. I picked it up in a sale at, I think, a model shop that was closing down. And yeah, it's a big 1/12 scale kit that I think a couple of times over the years I'd sort of looked at in a model shop and thought, oh, that's nice. Oh, that's expensive. Didn't buy it. But hey, closing down, half price. I bought it, and after it had been sitting around for a couple of years, I built it. By the way, it's not a terribly good kit. I had to modify several things on it to either make it more accurately resemble the car that it is representing, the sort of shark gill slat down the side are not very accurately represented, and I had to do a bit of work to make all that work. And the kind of the precision of the Revel mouldings is not up to Tamiya standards, I would have to say. If you're used to making those really beautifully put together Tamiya kits, this Revel kit to me was something of a disappointment. But it came together, it turned out beautifully, and it's a nice detailed model, which I really like. But I did a quick check on how much these things are if you wanted to pick one up on eBay. An unmade kit goes for more than £600.
Wow!
Which is extraordinary. I think I probably paid £30 or £40 for it. Ridiculous.
Yowza. Hey, I'm going to scoop that. Stand by. I'm just going to go through into this part of the room, recover something. Talk amongst yourselves for about 15 seconds.
Do we think he's going to bring some sort of intricate model car that's been on the shelf for ages?
I think it's got to be. Is it going to be a Ferrari? Will it be diecast or a kit? Will it be
a shooting brake of some description?
Ideally, it would be a 1/12 scale Airfix Bentley, which was would be one of the other model kits in my sort of, you know, mental map of lovely model cars that I've never acquired but always rather wanted. There was this big Airfix 1/12 scale Bentley that always looked fantastic. But there was a model shop up the road, Patrick's, that always had one, and I was envied it every time I went in there.
Is that a Lunar Lander made of champagne bits?
It is a Lunar Lander. I'm holding up to the camera a Lunar Lander.
Is it an edible Lunar Lander?
It's not edible.
That middle bit looks it. Oh, it is a champagne cork, isn't it?
It's all made from champagne cork wrapping and wire and stuff. And it's not just any Lunar Lander. If you know, that is the...
It was a Russian...
No. It's the Blue Origin, Blue Moon Lander with these particular, what do you call those things that direct the energy from the rockets at the top of the upper module there. And it's fairly accurate. I am currently building a model of the Orion spacecraft made out of...
Crisp packets.
It could be. It's actually, you know, mince pies, the silver foils that they sit in, that's the capsule. And I'm using coffee cups for the upper stage and everything. You watch, it's coming, it's coming. But that isn't what I slipped out the room to get. I've got to show you this. I noticed the other day that the first edition of Action Comics, the first ever Superman. Sold for how many million was it?
I don't know, but that's a legendarily expensive comic book. As somebody that doesn't collect comic books, even I'm aware that Action Comics number one is very, very valuable.
The one to go for. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Is that a model or is that a real one?
Is that genuine? That can't be. No, this is a copy. This is a print.
Unfortunately, it is a print.
It's a print. Yeah. It's printed off the cover of Action Comics number one. In color.
Printed in celebrating 50 years of Superman. So 1988, I bought a print of the first edition of Action Comics featuring Superman. It's not worth a million, but it might be worth a little bit of something there. I thought you'd appreciate that.
That's awesome.
It is. I think the only comic thing I've got that, well, it's not a comic book so much as a magazine that might possibly be worth anything. There was a magazine called White Dwarf that was published by the people that made Dungeons and Dragons.
The Warhammer magazine. People used to hand those around school like they were.
Yeah, well, I don't have edition number one of White Dwarf, but I've got edition number two somewhere. It might be worth 20 quid or something rather than, you know, nothing, which is what old magazines or comics are generally worth.
It's probably worth more than gold at the moment, or American dollars.
Well, yeah, I should have sold it for gold 10 years ago, then sold the gold 5 days ago, I guess. Whenever it was that it peaked.
Yeah. Hey, if only we lived in the future, we'd know that. But for now, for the present, Zog, thank you.
Always a pleasure. Lovely seeing you both.
Alex, nice to see you too, bro. Thank you.
Bye.
And catch you in a couple of weeks, where hopefully they will have fixed the hydrogen leak problems on the SLS. And Artemis 2 will be scheduled for a launch sometime in March. So still a bit of a build-up. I can't wait. On to the next thing. See you guys. Say bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this show, then please like, share and subscribe. For information on how to contact the show, see pictures, read song lyrics, follow us on social media, or to sponsor this podcast, go to garethjones.tv. Gareth Jones on Speed is made in Wales by Whiz Bang.
Gareth Jones on Speed!